Thanks, Amanda. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jamie McLean. I'm an associate director with PolicyLink, working on the convergence team at PolicyLink. And I am here to talk to you a little bit about evaluating convergence. I want to start by saying that I do not have any relationships to disclose. So as you heard from my esteemed colleagues here, the convergence partnership effort is really pursuing a really big vision, supporting and mobilizing a very broad network nationally, in regions, in communities across the country, and is implementing bold activities. And to say the least, it is complex work. I did a wordle of some of the words you've seen in this presentation so far. And this is only 85 of those words. And so these are some of the ideas and the themes and the issues that the partnership is addressing in its work. And in the 8 years since 2008 that PolicyLink has been working with the Convergence Partnership, I think one thing that has remained consistent is the partnership's full embrace of complexity. And in fact, it's embrace of the reality of interdependence, the interdependence of people, of policies, of practices, issues, and organizations, and the interdependence of the many problems and issues faced by communities. And this complexity and this interdependence can really present significant challenges to measurement, particularly where conventional evaluation practices and approaches are concerned. On one hand, we're looking at this idea of partnership across fields, across sectors, across institutions, within departments of agencies and institutions, within communities and the various agents within those communities, and partnerships involving different players depending on the issue and the social and political circumstances. We're thinking about measurement and complexity of equity, which involves creating policies that promote just and fair inclusion, as well as challenging the systems and changing processes themselves to become more inclusive and just. And then we're looking at the very simple issues of policy change and environmental change, thinking about the consideration of time scale and what kinds of resources, time-wise and energy-wise and financial resources, that go into change, that go into advocacy strategy, that go into the complex participation to create systemic change, both on in the short term as well as in the long term. And so these aspects of complexity, these aspects of interdependence, have really pushed us to pursue new approaches to measurement and evaluation and assessment and how we determine whether we are achieving success in our efforts. Our plans have evolved over time as the work has progressed, and limitations on funding have required us to be very strategic with our resources. One of our core values, one of the core values of the partnership, is learning. And we have learned a great deal about measurement and assessment in the 5 years. We have learned trial by fire. And I'm happy to share with you three of the lessons that we've learned in this process so far. The first is really to maintain a focus on the purpose of the work itself, as well as the purpose of measurement. From the very beginning of its work, the partnership has always prioritized these three, or actually four, key elements. The four elements have served as common threads through all of the work, and in turn, they've been the central focus of all of the measurement activities. They are how we define the success of the partnership. Our evaluation activities, whether looking inward at the partnership itself, at the members sitting at the steering committee table, or looking externally at their investments in advocacy, in field building, and in policy change, are asking about the changes that are being made in these specific areas. These elements have informed our specific evaluation questions. They've informed the indicators that we have selected, the outcomes that we have identified, and the instruments that we've developed for measurement. These four elements serve as the key themes in any evaluation reports that we receive or distribute. And so the purpose of our work, here, listed here, is the purpose that drives our measurement strategies. This purpose of measurement also relates to key questions around audience and needs and who and why we are, who we are measuring for and why we measure. And I mentioned earlier that learning is a core value of the partnership. And for Convergence, it's the measurement work is not just about identifying positive impacts and being able to report those to people or institutions in positions of power, being able to report those to foundation boards and so on, but it's about learning and commanding the full resources that the partnership can harness to make informed decisions within these changing and complex environments to help inform their strategy on an ongoing basis. And so we are really, we've talked a lot about feedback loops and ensuring that the evaluation work is integrated together with strategy and implementation. And it's challenging. It's very challenging. We're still working on improving the systems of feedback and being able to gather information quickly and put it to use quickly. We're in a process right now that is intentionally integrating our measurement approaches with the Convergence Partnership's next strategic planning process. So it's strategic planning for the next 3 years is really thinking proactively and prospectively about how to measure and what to measure. What's very promising for us is that there's a growing profession and a growing body of evaluators who are pursuing innovative and complex approaches to evaluation that match some of these values that we have and some of the work styles that we have. Developmental evaluation is one of these approaches. It recognizes the complexity of systems change and the need for dynamic and evolving measurement strategies that match those changes. It pushes away from the typical kind of midpoint and endpoint evaluations that are common in program evaluation and really pushes to encourage ongoing dialogue between the staff and the leadership as well as those tracking and evaluating the work. Which leads me to this third lesson around nimbleness, which is a word that you've heard several times in the presentations before me. We've had to adapt our evaluation approaches over time as we identify different needs, different programmatic strategies, different policy strategies, as we create changes and implement and learn. And this process is not dissimilar to what we do as we're pursuing our activities, where I think David and Chris and Amanda all mentioned the word strategic opportunism. That is something that the evaluation really needs to be dancing in step with the program that hasn't always been the case for us and something that we're working on refining. So our changes have led us to draw from different tools over time to identify these pathways to change. This conceptual map for Convergence was really our first logic model. As you can see, it's fairly linear. We used this in our first phase evaluation, and it was early on in the partnership, and I don't think we really anticipated as a partnership just how we would be implementing this strategic opportunism. And so all of our evaluation resources went into evaluating, looking internally at the partners and the process of trust and collaboration and operations within the partnership, but also looking externally. And we dedicated our evaluation resources to three major investment areas that the partnership had identified early on in the in that strategic phase. And those were around Innovation Fund, around Regional Convergence, and around what was a priority at the time, the Federal Transportation Reauthorization policy work. The findings from this evaluation were very, very helpful for us. They helped to articulate what some of the contributions the partnership had made to these different efforts, and they helped to characterize what the work actually looked like from a funder collaborative. However, as we were doing this work, we felt that there was such a great need for a better understanding of what was happening on the ground, that there was a lot that the partnership was doing, new opportunities that were coming up that we no longer had evaluation resources to pursue. And so that led us to think a little bit differently about how we articulate our work and how we measure it. I'm hitting the back button. And so we moved ahead and developed this theory of change, which served as a much better tool for communicating how and the what of our work. You can see here that equity is at the center. Equity is also an outcome. Equity is an ongoing outcome that we are seeking. We're looking to change policies and systems, but we're looking to change those policies and systems to help address power imbalances. And so when we're doing our work, we're thinking about partnerships and those power imbalances and how to shift them. And so this theory of change does a great job in terms of helping to articulate some of that work, the connections between the partner investments and these values and outcomes. However, in using it for measurement, we found that we needed something a little bit more detailed than this, that helps to connect the specific strategies and the specific investments with these various outcomes. But this theory of change in our second phase of work, we're moving into our third, was really critical for helping us to synthesize the results that we had received to date, and we were able to really start putting together the story of convergence, which involves these many, many ideas, many actors, many players. And so fast forward to now, and we are moving through a different process, and we're in the process right now of developing what are called outcome maps to help clearly articulate the complex connections between the strategies of the partnership, the vision of the partnership, and all of the various outcomes that we seek in between. This outcome mapping process is part of our shift to embrace emerging measurement strategies. In the fields of developmental evaluation, there's also a lot of work happening in advocacy and policy change evaluation that wasn't as robust, 10 years ago. We are leveraging important tools like outcome maps and developmental evaluation strategies as we enter our next phase of work. And this outcome map will serve to both inform our strategic planning process and the decisions the partnership will make about where and how it plans to invest, but also will inform the measurement. So we're going to do those in parallel rather than in sequence. I think Chris mentioned earlier the term collective impact, which is another one of these models that is coming out of the evaluation field. And it's something that we are very excited about and keeping a close eye on, because there's a lot of parallels between the collective impact model, the five different features of a backbone organization, of a shared agenda, shared measurement strategies, and so on. But we're also thinking about collective impact in terms of what sets convergence apart from that. And we've had lots of discussions about that and are thinking more about how we can articulate what the convergence difference may be. I wanted to share a few of the kind of core features of developmental evaluation here with you. I'm not going to read them all to you, but you see some key words here that are very much in line with the convergence approach. Again, the traditional evaluation approach has been to really focus on formative evaluation and summative evaluation to kind of highlight findings at midpoint, endpoint, look back at what has happened. Developmental evaluation happens in step with the program and the policy work that is occurring at the time. You see under number three that it includes the word nimble is used here, and that is a critical aspect of being able to effectively measure the success of the partnership and the strategic opportunistic value that the partners hold. And so as we pursue these methods, we're continually identifying new strategies and approaches that we can integrate into our evaluation work. We're quickly learning ways to both improve our effectiveness and impact, and improving how we do our work so that we really are able to change conditions in communities to create healthy people, healthy places, and to help foster greater equity. So with that, I will close. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you to all of our panelists. And now we will take the
last few minutes of our session and open it up for questions and comments.
Sure. I'll take your first question first. There's a lot to unpack there. First, in terms of how we talked about it with the Northwest Health Foundation, it was actually very easy to talk about it because through another grant program, we are already funding an advocacy group called CAUSA that, together with some other partners, had been working on this issue for at least 2 years. And so we were already familiar with it. It's I have to be careful. It's not something we were pushing at this convening, saying, hey, you've got to jump on this bandwagon. But in terms of internally with the Northwest Health Foundation, it felt like a perfect fit. So what was interesting is for a lot of folks who were in that room, there are 100 people in the room, either A, they had never kind of traced their food that far upstream to think about it in that way, or B, they hadn't really put an explicit social justice lens on their food work. And, you know, things like, you know, driver's licenses for undocumented workers, that forces you to go that far upstream, and that forces you to consider the social justice implications. So it was actually really eye-opening. And that came through in the post-event evaluations, too. It was like, that where people were almost kind of like embarrassed that they hadn't thought of that before. But it was really terrific to see what I would call more mainstream food organizations actually kind of open their eyes and say, yeah, this is an issue we need to care about as well. In terms of Kaiser Permanente, they have, and I'd say this about Meyer Memorial Trust too, they had to be a little bit more careful in the policy realm than we could. So Northwest Health Foundation, its endowment is incorporated as a C4 rather than a C3. So that gave us a tremendous amount of latitude to take positions on legislation, for example, and you know, KP couldn't say like go out and endorse Senate Bill 833, but they certainly understood its connection to healthy food systems. Okay, sure. Mm-hmm. So for example, with Senate Bill 833, I don't know if there was one backbone, probably CAUSA more than others, but there were at least 9 organizations that were involved in pushing that legislation. And what was interesting, I think one reason they were so successful is non-traditional partners. So yes, they had all the social justice folks. They also had the Nursery Association, which nurseries is the largest cash crop in the state of Oregon. So you had a bunch of nursery owners going down to legislature and talking to their more conservative members saying, I need a workforce, otherwise my business is dead. You had the Sheriff's Association saying, guess what, you know, our roads are going to be safer if people actually have driver's licenses. I would rather have everyone out there on the road have a driver's license than people, you know, taking those risks. You had faith leaders. So it was really a very broad coalition. I think that was one reason for its success. I don't want to hog the microphone.
Other questions, Victor?
Jamie, thanks for taking us through all those. I actually had to order to go ask if you're not here yet.
That's a great question. It's a little premature in the sense that we will be having our first conversation with the partners about the outcome map this week. And so nothing on the outcome map right now is in stone, just in light here. And so what I can tell you about it is that it starts at the bottom with the strategies. and the really specific activities that the partnership engages in, the investments that it makes, the values that it carries to the work when it's doing TA with regions that are looking to form their own collaboratives, when it's looking to create changes in the built environment or in food systems at the local level through the Innovation Fund, and so on. And then it moves through the kind of sequence, so to speak, because it's not linear, but there is some linearity to it of what transpires and then what follows from that, and then ultimately gets to this goal of healthy people, healthy places, and equitable communities. And so I think at a future date, I would be happy to disclose what some of those specifics are. I realize that the fonts were it's a little hard to read, but that was intentional on some level. But just to give a sense of, just to give a little bit of a sense of how we've been thinking about this at the broader level. So in looking at this, you see at the very top this goal around healthy people, healthy places. Every community fosters health, prosperity, and well-being for all. And we see one precursor to that is improved environments. To get to the improved environments, we have to improve policies and practices. We have to implement those policies and practices. There needs to be greater collaboration that leads to those policy changes and the implementation of those changes. To get to some of those changes, there has to be greater will and institutional will. And so the partnership is consistently and constantly pivoting in their efforts and where they're applying pressure, depending on what the project is, what the policy is, what the issue is, to press on these various components. So stay tuned.
I think there was a question here, and then just quickly, just to add to this, that literally we will be doing these exercises with the partners in the next 2 days, and I think what is so exciting about this new approach is part of our work is to determine the pathways from the strategies at the very bottom through the very top of our vision of healthy people, healthy places. What is the pathway that we have used in the current existing activities that we're engaged in, and is that really leading us to our ultimate outcome? And then having a very similar conversation about, well, in the new investments or activities that we will be engaging in this next multi-year strategic plan, do those pathways still hold? And are there different pathways that we'll need to take in order to get to our ultimate vision? And what does that mean for the types of investments and partners and activities that we will engage in? So very much a deliberate process to align measurement and activity and strategy and throughout the entire process. So, go ahead.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, excellent questions, and I don't think we have an answer, at least from the Michigan Convergence point of view, because it's I'd say pretty formative. You know, actually, Amanda's probably a little bit closer to the actual sausage making than I am at this point. The reason that this came about, though, is that as we began to work with the community, various community partners on the ground, it was very clear that we share this agenda around equity. You know, but you had people working specifically on sort of jobs, getting people to jobs, and also a very progressive kind of planning organization community in the state, which is really trying to align sort of land use issues with economic development, especially around low-income communities. And then there was also very strong lobby around access to education, you know, a lot of stuff, you know, related just to, you know, getting the auto industry kind of back on its feet too. So, but you had a lot of sort of movement on the ground that were really sort of moving in the sort of same direction. And there was a sort of sense that we really shared a common agenda, albeit in different silos. And so that's why, you know, that particular issue came up to the fore, I'd say, at this point. And I think the next step is to then, you know, put some legs onto that and figure out exactly what that means. Having said that, I mean, there are groups on the ground that are actually doing real work, you know. And there's some sense that, you know, for example, there's a lot of work on the food area. In fact, it's just a truly robust area. That's everything from sustainable ag through, you know, healthy retail and a lot of different aspects of it. A lot of food hub work going on in the state. You know, is there an opportunity to sort of marry that as an economic opportunity for the people that are interested in jobs? You know, and that conversation had not happened in the state. So, you know, this potentially becomes, and here I'm just speaking prospectively because this is something that, you know, I think we just sort of imagined could happen. But the fact that conversation hadn't happened, you know, to me was like just an opportunity that was sort of laying out there to be, you know, missed. And then you had folks working on transportation policy and realizing that there was a huge mismatch in terms of access to public transportation where the jobs were. And, you know, to the extent that people on the public health side, you know, we're trying to get people into walkable communities and that sort of a thing. It was like, well, you know, we have to work together on these things, right? But those conversations don't happen in the typical spheres we have. So we just realized that there was this huge opportunity to really, you know, to do the silo busting, you know, in the state just because of the nature of activism in Michigan. You know, as I said, I'm not from there, but I will say that. What has struck me is the history and tradition of labor organizing is really very powerful in the state, and you cannot discount that in a state like Michigan. In other places it may not matter, but in a state like Michigan, you have to pay attention to it.
Yes, absolutely. So on our website, convergencepartnership.org, we actually have profiles and contact information of each of the 14 regional convergence partnerships. And certainly I am happy to talk with you about any possibilities or any of you possibilities about forming a regional convergence partnership in your state. Now, what we typically mean by region has been state, multi-county, or large metropolitan area. So that's what we have defined as a regional convergence. And also plug you in for those where we have existing partnerships. Certainly happy to plug you into those collaboratives.
Or innovation grants.
Or as well, yes. As well as innovation grants, we can also connect you to those particular foundations.
I think it's important to note that we can also connect you with other agencies in other regions that have helped to foster a regional convergence in their area or are working closely with it under collaborative. So that is something to think about as well.
Other questions? Yes.
Several of you mentioned the collective impact model. And I know that you have mentioned, Jamie, that you were discussing it as a potential model, but that you were looking at the convergence partnership being different. So I don't know if you're willing to share. Obviously, there have been conversations around it. I'm just curious to know, on a practical or a philosophical level, what kind of differences between a collective impact model and your convergence partnership?
I'd like to preface my statement by saying that some of those conversations have been they're mainly informal conversations where we're looking at this model that in very many ways describes many aspects of convergence. We have a backbone organization. The partners develop a shared agenda. They are using a shared measurement strategy. There is significant collaboration and alignment of resources. And I'm forgetting the fifth element of collective impact. Yes, mutually reinforcing roles. Thank you. So there is all of that, but it feels like something is missing, and I personally, and so I'm speaking on my own here, I personally think it's something about the equity piece, because that is fundamental to how the work is done and what the aim of the work is. And that's different from there being a theme or an issue that maybe has an endpoint. This is something that is an ingredient swirled into all of those pieces that could be a bullet point under each of those pieces, but could also be a separate element on its own. And so that's where I sit on it. I think it would be a great, robust discussion for us to have more broadly. And I'm sure David and Chris and Amanda have other thoughts, so I'm going to retreat from the microphone.
Most of the collective impact studies, case studies, have been at a local level. And the fact that we have both sort of a local component as well as a national component, to me, where the similarity kind of breaks down is at the national level, because we're not really trying to do a thing, right? But yet there's collective work, but there is impact, but it's not quite the same. And the other thing that I think that has been talked about as much is influence, which to me is a really interesting phenomenon. You know, the fact that any one of those foundations by itself, if Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, you know, were to speak up, for example, and these days they're less likely to just because of some history, but they would have a lot of influence. But the fact that you have all these foundations, especially some of the leading health foundations in the country, you know, speaking with one voice about certain aspects of broader policy and saying that transportation policy is health policy, that gives like a whole, I mean, that stuff that you could say or the Boston, you know, Public Health Commission could say, but the fact that these funders are saying it, I mean, I don't want to toot our horn, because I sit back and realize for some reason people listen to us. And we might as well just leverage that influence where we can, you know, and you know, to the extent that we can, I mean, we might as well just, you know, keep walking through it. So that to me is one of the more interesting, and I don't know, you know, we haven't even talked about that, but to me the interesting thing is how much entree we've had to actual federal rulemaking, policy making, you know, behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Amanda, what do you do?
Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, Jamie mentioned something I think is important because with collective impact, I guess, first of all, how many of you have read the actual paper, Collective Impact by FSG? Okay, most of you, okay. I mean, I think, you know, one reason it resonated with so many people is because a lot of people read it said, oh, yeah, we're already doing some or most of that. And, of course, this makes sense, and, oh, we just need to add this one component. So it was very intuitive. Right, and they had some really compelling case studies. Plus, they just are marketing the heck out of it. They are. I mean, I don't begrudge them that, but they are very aggressive, you know, in getting their vision out there. But one thing Jamie said really struck me because it's a very mechanistic model, right? I mean, it's not a values-based model, and that, you know, that's okay if you need both, right? But I think what Jamie was saying about, you know, how do you overlay equity on top of that? I think the values are what get people committed. You know, the values are what make people stick. It's not necessarily the mechanisms. The mechanisms are important, but you need both. The final thing I'll say is just as a funder, before I left North of South Foundation, it seemed like every other proposal I got was using the term collective impact at 90% of them were using it incorrectly. So it became this, it went through this arc of what's collective impact to, I want collective impact to, oh, of course we're doing collective impact. And I think it's being used not always in the most productive way. That said, you know, in its pure form, it does have a lot of utility. I would just add that values layer to it.
We just have about 3 minutes left. Yes.
So I think my question is, so you have a number of foundations within the collaborative, and they are working with your grantees, I assume, with an equity lens. And I'm wondering, given that grantees are in all of these silos, if I use, say, healthy eating, for instance, I've worked with a number of hunger groups and healthy eating groups, and a lot of them, especially the very traditional ones, do not have equity as a lens. And I've found that it's been very difficult to really work in coalition when you're trying to have a consensus around values and strategies. And I just found that the equity piece is just very difficult for a lot of organizations. You can't overlay it because it's a way of how you are doing the work. And so I'm just wondering if there have been conversations within your collaborative about getting to the grantees.
Do you want to start? I mean, you kind of touched on that earlier in your opening remarks about how challenging the equity conversation can be. I can.
Yeah. Peggy, that's a good question, and I think like I said, one of the things we found in trying to work with, especially sort of the regional convergences, is that was a difficult conversation because they might have been doing very, very good work, but they hadn't thought about the equity thing. So there's obviously just a pure education piece on that, and I think that I have found anyway that having data to sort of support the underlying sort of values, you know, point that, you know, it's not only right and just to do this kind of a thing. You know, I mean, those who have not been served ought to be, you know, served, and they ought to be in fact engaged in the process. But that if you begin to look at, well, if you're really interested in issues like, you know, hunger, nutrition, access to food, you know, or physical activity, or any, you know, access to whatever, you know, the good life, you know, you're trying to define, and you show that there is this basically, you know, uneven table or uneven playing field to do that, you know, and just show it either geographically or by data, you know, that this isn't a matter of disparities; it's a matter of truly unequal access and inclusion in various things, and that sometimes is an eye opener. It is more difficult in areas where it's socially difficult, sort of like socially and politically difficult to talk about that issue, i.e., you know, like, you know, places in the South or even rural areas. So all those things are, you know, things that get balanced.
Chris, do you want to add?
Sure. I mean, I actually had a similar experience in Pacific Northwest, you know, which is not the most diverse region in the country. But, you know, we had, you know, a number of, you know, very well-meaning, very committed folks, but, you know, say, well, had not really explicitly, you know, dived into the equity considerations. Perhaps didn't have a comfort level or hadn't been provided a comfort level to have those discussions. I think that was one real eye-opener when we had our convening, and that the number one priority that came out was restoring access to driver's license for undocumented workers. There are a whole bunch of folks in the room who are like, wow, that's really out there. I want a community garden for my kid's school. We're talking about some really radical stuff, but then they, you know, they kind of got us like, no, that should be on our organization's agenda as well. Not everybody, of course. You know, but I think, I mean, the environmental movement overall, I know food systems is just, you know, there's an overlap there. It's not perfect. You know, has taken some knocks in the mainstream environmental movement for not being as inclusive as it should be. not being calling out racial inequity when it should. I think some of the folks, at least in our neck of the woods, Pacific Northwest, sometimes came to food systems work through that environmental lens, and perhaps were thinking morningly about, well, what types, is it organic? Is it sustainably grown? Which I'm not knocking that. That's important. But never really thought about inequities all the way through the food chain. And what it meant for people who are actually out in the field, or what it meant for people who, couldn't access affordable, healthy food. And what are the structural barriers that create that disparity in access and opportunity? So these are not easy conversations for everybody. I mean, and they shouldn't be. The more we kind of expand the circle and bring people in and create a space for that conversation, I think the more traction we'll get, at least optimistically. That's what I hope.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our session. Thank you so much again to our panelists, and a big round of applause for them. Thank you to all of you, and have a great afternoon.